This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Available now on the documentary from the BBC World Service.
I'm Mike Waldridge, and I'm talking to Australian peace activist Donna Mulhern about her decision to go to Iraq as a human shield to try to prevent the West from going to war with Saddam Hussein. It didn't succeed, but does she still think she did the right thing?
Listen now by searching for the documentary wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello, I'm Audrey Brown, and today in Focus on Africa, what next for Mali, now that the multinational United Nations peacekeeping mission is ending? A first in the Miss Universe pageant, the possibility of a hijabi-wearing queen.
I came here with the mindset of winning. If it's possible for me to be here, why is it not possible for me to win? And Miss Universe is determined by her looks, by her advocacy, by how she speaks, the confidence that she has. And if I'm able to check every single one of those boxes, why should I not be allowed to be Miss Universe just because of my hijab?
That's Miss Universe Somalia, who will be strutting her stuff wearing a hijab in competition in Mexico this weekend. It's Friday, the 15th of November. First, we go to South Africa. For decades, the country was the world's leading gold producer. Beginning in the 1880s, the industry drew millions of workers from across the region to mine that gold. It led to the creation of South Africa and changed the trajectory of the territory and that of Britain, which was the colonial power. Gold and diamonds, which were discovered earlier, led to huge development, but it also created massive inequalities, which in turn led to a monumental struggle for dignity and equality, led by political organizations like the governing African National Congress and labor organizations like the National Union of Mine Workers. So crucial was the role of the mine workers in that struggle that the most powerful politicians in South Africa today were leaders of the Mine Workers Union. That includes the current president of the country, Cyril Ramaphosa. In the last 50 years, gold mining has declined and thousands of mines are decommissioned. Those mines are now being exploited illegally by informal miners. They are called zamazamas, which roughly translates as take a chance in local languages in South Africa. Thousands of men are currently stuck down a shaft in the northwestern province. The government is taking a hard line against these men, branding them as foreign criminals. And the police are stopping people from the communities around the mines from helping them. Cabinet Minister Kumbuzo Ntshavheni was speaking earlier this week.
We're not sending help to criminals. We're going to smoke them out. They will come out. We are not sending help to criminals. Criminals are not to be helped. Criminals are to be persecuted. We didn't send them there. And they didn't go down there for the good benefit or good intentions for the Republic. So we can't help them. Those who want to help them, they must go and take the food down there. They will come out. We'll arrest them.
Many South Africans were outraged by Kumbuzo Ntshavheni's remarks, and hundreds of members of the community around the mine have been on site to give the mine workers food and water and to help those who want to surface. They've pulled out at least one decomposing body as well. So how did it come to this? David van Wyk is the lead researcher with Benchmarks Foundation, an organization that is trying to provide and uphold standards of good corporate governance and ethical investment.
So we've got 6,000 abandoned mines in this country, and they are increasing all the time. You know, and that's a huge problem because the law says a mining company cannot abandon a mine. It actually has an obligation, a legal obligation, to rehabilitate the mine and to restore the environment. But of course, that's impossible. You know, anyone who knows mining will know that that simply cannot be done. As Benchmarks Foundation, we've suggested, A, that we plan for a transition to smaller scale mining, and B, that we also see if we can repurpose and re-engineer existing mines for other economic purposes so that there's a post-mining economy and towns don't have to die.
So I'm wondering about the effect that that has on the people in those mining towns. What happens to them? Because basically, you're talking about an environment that's not rehabilitated and you're talking about people who don't have jobs.
you find that retrenched mine workers very often end up in these old mines. While they're not profitable for large-scale industrial mining, they are profitable for smaller-scale mining, but they are there illegally. You know, so many of them are migrant workers. They came from labor-sending areas in Mozambique, Zimbabwe, Swaziland, or Eswatini, and Lesotho, and the Eastern Cape, of course. They are then stuck in the mining towns themselves being unemployed. And there are two options for them. One is violent contact crime, or the other is to go underground and dig for what is there. And then, of course, criminal syndicates take advantage of that situation. They organize above ground for the gold to be bought and to be processed through the system. And then they actually super exploit these mine workers that are underground.
I was wondering what happens to whatever they mine. And is it mainly gold?
In different provinces, different minerals are mined. In Gauteng, Northwest Province, Free State, it's mainly gold. In parts of Northwest and Limpopo, it is chrome. And the nature of the illegal mining differs from province to province. So the Limpopo and Northwest chrome operations are actually big in scale. The chrome is not deep underground, and all you need is graders and trucks. And these guys actually have graders and trucks to load the chrome onto trucks and then to get the chrome processed and out of the country. And so those guys are not the same thing as the Zamazama small-scale guy who used to be a mine worker who goes underground and so on to eke out a living, or who reworks old mine waste dumps and so on.
I know that Zamazama in South African languages, in Xhosa and Zulu, means try, try. Why are they called Zamazama?
Well, I think they're trying to make a living. I think that, you know, if you take out 36,000 Zamazamas from underground in the Gauteng province, you're going to create major economic problems. 36,000 people at a dependency ratio of 1 to 8 means that's like 300,000 people that are dependent on their income. And if you stop them from doing this mining, you are actually going to impact on the demand situation in the Gauteng province, and you are going to deepen the economic crisis there and lead to further unemployment. That's why Benchmarks Foundation feels that there should be a policy to begin to decriminalize the operations, to better organize them and to regulate them.
And yet the Minister of Mining is taking a very, very hard line to the people, around 4,000 or so of them, that are right now in a mine shaft. I heard the comments. They are being referred to as criminals, and the intention is to starve them, basically.
We have a constitution, a very liberal constitution, in which the right to life is sacrosanct, and in which you are not guilty until proven otherwise in a court of law. And that, you know, you cannot execute someone or sentence them to death or harm them in any way as a form of punishment unless they've been through a court of law. And even then, we've abolished corporal punishment and the death penalty and so on. And so the way in which you deal with this particular issue with these guys that are underground at the moment is you really can't starve. The government will find itself in court, and it will lose the cases in court if it does go to court. It's a situation that cannot be solved by policing or the military. It is a situation that can be resolved through planning, coordination, and better organization of a transition from large-scale mining to small and medium-scale mining.
It seemed like there was a kind of hardline attitude based on a set of assumptions about these people. I think I know lots of South Africans think that they come from elsewhere. Were South Africans actually outraged and shocked, or did they shrug it off and say, well, these people are here illegally, these are illegal miners, and they deserve what they get?
There is a wave of xenophobia sweeping through the country at the moment, and that is really pushed by politicians. But the people who came up from underground here is a mixed group. And, you know, I've worked a lot with Zamazamas throughout the country, and these operations are very organized, and there's a very sharp division of labor between people who does what underground and also above ground. But also the other thing is that the authorities are not arresting mine bosses for not closing and rehabilitating mines. They are also not arresting the kingpins who are living in the leafy suburbs of Johannesburg and Cape Town.
The people that are eking a living out underground are not the main culprits.
No, they're definitely not. The people who process the ore are getting the ore in a very raw form, and then, of course, have to process it into quantities that would make economic sense. If you operate with these guys underground in the gold mines, you don't have any overhead costs. You don't pay for electricity. You don't pay for water. You don't pay the pensions and medical aid of these workers who are underground. because they don't have medical aid or pensions or anything like that. And you can pay them 50% less than what the unionized workers get, and they will never go on strike. And you can keep them underground from between 3 to 6 months at a time.
Just bring us up to date with what's happening with the miners that are right now trapped in that shaft.
Well, the situation at the moment is that community members have stepped in and started taking water down and food down to these workers after they've not had access to food and water for more than 1.5 weeks. And community members are trying to negotiate the mine workers underground to surface. I also see a softening in the tone of the government, and there will be government, senior government officials and ministers visiting that mine. I think that people are realizing that the hardline is not something that will work, and that they actually need to talk their way out of this. You can't shoot your way out of it.
Do you think government will listen and actually hold the miners and the mine owners accountable to the extent that they can make sure that people don't come to harm when they are in those mines, or to regularize the artisanal and small-scale examiners?
Look, we work closely with the National Association of Artisanal Miners as Benchmarks Foundation. We contributed to the national policy on artisanal mining in the country. We were hoping that the application of that policy will begin to assist to address the particular problem. But in its opening statement, it says its purpose is to open up mining to all South Africans, you know, to make all South Africans participant in the mining process. And what better way to do so than artisanal and small-scale mining, well organized?
That's David van Wyk, lead researcher with Benchmarks Foundation in South Africa. Now to Mali, where the United Nations peacekeeping mission is being ended. MINUSMA, as it is known, was sent after a secessionist rebellion and military takeover back in 2013. The government at the time requested help from France and the United Nations to contain the threats it faced from a Tuareg separatist movement, a military insurrection, and later an Islamist insurgency. MINUSMA, or to give it its full name, the Multidimensional Integrated Stabilization Mission, was meant to protect civilians and stabilize Mali. Instead, Mali suffered two coups, and by 2023, the transitional government expelled the force, saying it had failed to bring peace and stability to the country. And here we are today, Friday the 15th of November. It's the date set for the complete withdrawal of MINUSMA. Let's discuss why the force was not able to fulfill its mission and what happens next in Mali. Dr. Alex Vines is the research director of the Africa Programme at the London-based international think tank Chatham House. Why is MINUSMA so risky?
MINUSMA's been such a risky peacekeeping operation because of the challenges. So that's radical Islamic groups, both groups affiliated with Islamic State, but also with Al-Qaeda, but also very hostile host government and our militias associated with it. And so it was the most dangerous UN peacekeeping operation in the world. There were 11,000 peacekeepers, more or less, at its peak, but it was increasingly finding it difficult to fulfill a peacekeeping mandate.
Did many of them die in clashes and so on, or were they sort of targeted?
The fatalities were the highest in the world, and it was difficult increasingly to find recruitment to replenish the supporting nations. So MINUSMA struggled, and things really worsened over a decade. So this year is the 10th anniversary of MINUSMA, and of course it's closing it down, its operations now.
In fact, it was judged to be unsuccessful because of the fact that it wasn't able to bring stability to Mali. Or was it unsuccessful because so many people died in the attempt?
I think the reality for MINUSMA is that in its early days it was more successful. But as your listeners will know, there have been a series of coups in Mali. And the current junta in Mali decided that MINUSMA was no longer fulfilling what it wanted it to do, which was to provide security, so more like a peacemaking operation rather than a peacekeeping one, and asked for it to leave. And the casualties also and costs increased. But at the end of the day, MINUSMA's leaving Mali because the Malian authorities, the junta there, said get out. That's why they've gone. It's not because the UN didn't want to continue to engage in Mali in some sort of peacekeeping stabilization mission.
What were the initial objectives of MINUSMA, and did it suffer something that is often called mission creep over the years?
Well, it was never designed, I think, MINUSMA to deal with the realities of Mali. Increasingly, UN operations have been pushed more and more into peacemaking function rather than the traditional peacekeeping one. And Mali in particular had already been struggling. The regional body, the ECOWAS, the continental body all had tried different formulas that hadn't worked. The French had very heavily engaged on a bilateral basis, and there was this hope that a multilateral approach might provide some support to stabilize Mali. That didn't occur over a decade, and the Malian junta, the colonels in Mali, have looked for other partners, and so they call loyal partners countries like China, the Russian Federation, Iran and Turkey, for example. And those are the countries that Mali is now looking to provide security support for it.
They're being kicked out now. What's the next plan? Because doesn't Mali still need a protective force?
Mali can't provide the security guarantees it needs for its civilian population and to provide security for its economic partners, the mining companies, for example, without support. And so Mali has turned to countries like the Russian Federation. But as I mentioned, it also regards loyal partnerships. It's called them as such loyal partners. China, Turkey and Iran, they've been name-checked by the Malian junta as particularly important for it. And so I think Mali's junta will be looking for those types of relationships. The Russian one obviously is quite deep. The form of, well, Wagner now, the Africa Corps, remain deeply involved in Mali. But having said that, I do sense that the Malian junta is beginning to see that it needs to diversify its security partnerships, because some of the loyal partners like the Russians are not delivering in the way that the Malians had hoped for. So we'll see. We'll see where this goes. Mali will need security partnerships and assistance, given the threats that it's experiencing, including by the Al-Qaeda-affiliated and IS-affiliated insurgent groups.
How did the people of Mali perceive MINUSMA? There were incidents in the past of hostility towards the forces, but was there support or criticism from the local population, and did that evolve over the years?
That's a good question. And a bit like the French intervention when it first happened in 2013, initially it was welcomed by civilian populations, particularly in the capital, Bamako. But over time, that ebbed away when the interventions, be they the French or later the UN, wasn't able to improve security. And disillusionment sat in. And this is where I think increasingly people also then look to the Malian military to maybe a pathway through these problems. And so I think one can explain the original support for the first coup and to a degree the second coup in Mali in recent years as following that trajectory. What Malians want is a peaceful, prosperous country. There's no doubt about it. But there remains some sympathy to the junta that it is ending neocolonialism, that it's not following a traditional path of the close relationship with France that previously had happened through previous administrations in Bamako. But that will only last for a certain extent, because at the end of the day, you know, reduction of inflation, improved livelihoods, improved security is what Malians that I speak to really want.
Thank you very much. That's Dr. Alex Vines, Research Director of the Africa Program at the international think tank Chatham House. This is Focus on Africa from the BBC World Service.
Witness the stories that have shaped our world.
On the launch pad, in the dawn light, a towering symbol of an ambitious nation.
3, 2, 1.
The whole of India was watching.
Told by the people who were there.
I still don't regret that I was part of Rose Revolution. I was a witness of very exciting days.
Witness history from the BBC World Service. Listen wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
From the stifling heat of Hagadera refugee camp in Kenya to the cold but welcoming streets of Canada, and now the stage of Miss Universe, Khadija Omar's life path has been a fascinating one. She was born in that camp after her parents had to leave their homes in Somalia and Sudan due to conflict and drought. They left the camp to settle in Canada when she was just 10 years old. This weekend, Khadija may make history as the first hijab-wearing Miss Universe. She is competing in the headscarf, also a first for the pageant, which will be held in Mexico. Miss Khadija is also the first Miss Universe Somalia competitor. So it's a momentous weekend of firsts. We called up Khadija in the small hours of the night for her, where she is, to talk about her life up to now. What time is it where you are?
It is currently 3 a.m. and we have just finished the preliminary show for Miss Universe.
Oh my goodness. See, how are you managing? Do you get a nap in the afternoon at least? You need your beauty sleep.
Yes, yes, of course. So I do sometimes when I find breaks in rehearsals or just a little 1 hour break, I'll take a nap. But it is the last 2 days of Miss Universe. So I'm here to put everything that I've got. It's the first time representing my country. So I really want to make my country proud.
And it's also the first time that a Miss Universe contestant will be wearing a hijab. That's a big deal, isn't it? How big a deal is it for you and why is it important?
I have to say this has honestly been a dream of mine for so long. Ever since I was young, I knew that I really loved the beauty and fashion industry. But not seeing someone that has ever represented someone who looked like me made me not as confident growing up. And that's where I got the love for it. And I told myself, I can be the first one. I don't have to be scared. I can be fearless, create my own path, because I know that by doing that, I'm able to inspire so many others to also be confident in their own skin. So this has honestly been a journey that I have been waiting for so long. And has really showed me that when you don't give up on a dream that you have, that anything is truly possible.
But tell me why it was so important for you to be seen represented as wearing the hijab.
The reason why I really wanted to represent wearing the hijab is because a lot of the times when people think of a beauty pageant, they just think of girls who are on stage to showcase their beauty, their walk. But when you really look at every single queen, they all have a story. They all have a journey, some struggles they've went through and some challenges they have overcome. And it's so inspiring. And I also want to show the world that you don't have to even show your hair to be beautiful, because beauty is not based on your appearance. And my whole life, I always knew that, but I felt like the way that beauty standards were set up, it always showed that you must have good hair. Your skin has to show. And I've always realized growing up that as a woman, you're always told what you can wear, what you can't wear. And I wanted to break the limits and showcase that you can really do what you want as long as you're confident. The universe is always ready to accept it.
But when I think of beauty pageants, I don't think about hair and skin only. I also think about the amount of skin that is actually shown. And that is that, you know, you walk around in a bikini, you know, your shape, your body type. The hijab doesn't do anything about that, does it?
Even right now, if you look at Miss Universe, there is over 127 countries that have competed this year. And we're really showcasing that beauty can come in all forms, because being a hijabi should not define whether or not I can compete in a pageant. And for so long, people told me that you can't be a hijabi and compete in a pageant. And I really never understood that, because I said, well, if every single person could go on Miss Universe and represent their country, why can I not also represent my country and represent my faith at the same time doing it? So it's been incredible.
So will you be taking part in the bikini contest?
This is a question that a lot of people had. And as a Muslim woman, I wear something called a burkini. So it's a full body suit that covers my skin from neck to toe. And then I have a cape over it. And this is usually what Muslim women wear when they're swimming. And a lot of people don't realize that we also go swimming, which shocks me, because I think it showcases people that swimsuit is more than just your skin. It's the confidence you're able to give when you're walking.
The anticipation, you must be feeling it, thinking about how you're going to represent. But I'm imagining that you're also thinking back to where you started before you got to this point in your life. Just tell us about your beginnings.
My journey started in the King Hagada refugee camp, where I lived for almost 10 years. My mom left the war in Somalia and my dad left the war in Sudan, and they met in the refugee camp and they had us. And growing up, I've always went through so many different challenges, but I've always wanted something so big for my life. And from a very young age, I never let my current situation determine what was possible for me to do. And just living there, I just remember so many stories of when I used to even just make stick dolls and play. And so I knew from a very young age I loved beauty. I even remember when I was sitting around with kids and all talk about the different dreams that we had. And I think what was so beautiful is that even though we lived in a refugee camp, each one of us had a story. Each one of us had a mission to make a difference in this world. And we really didn't let the refugee limit us. And the moment I moved to Canada, I noticed that that was my opportunity to be able to go after every single one of my dreams and to not let anybody tell me no for anything, because I saw Canada as a land of opportunity. And that's what it gave me. It opened so many doors for me. I was finally able to get education. I didn't have education for over 10 years when I was in the refugee camp. So when I was learning, I realized that I loved art, and getting into art, that's when I found my passion in beauty.
Give us an idea, because so many people listening now hear about refugee camps, but they don't really understand what life is like in a refugee camp.
I have to say, I think growing up, there's a lot of different traumatic experience that I have went through. And my brain has kind of almost like, especially the most traumatic ones, has forgotten it. But I do remember times where growing up in a refugee camp, you really felt like the world didn't know about you. Nobody knows about the struggles that you're going through. And that is why even with my advocacy for Miss Universe, it's about focusing on displaced communities, especially in the refugee camp, being able to give them access to education, access to healthcare, because I want them to know that they are not ignored and there are people out there who hear their story and who are making sure that they are being provided for.
Now, you have an intimate understanding of displacement and the experience of refugees. What do you think we should tell the world about people who live in camps and people who are experiencing displacement?
From my point of view, what I would tell the world is that we need to start paying attention, especially because people who are displaced, as someone who has been displaced for over 10 years, I had so much skills, so much potential, but I felt like my dreams were not reachable because I didn't have the resources for it. And I think as a society, we need to come together to make sure that these individuals have the resources to fully reach their potential, because it is not okay that someone grows up for over 10 years not being even able to have access to education. And education is a key to be able to open the doors for so many things in life that they wanted to do. I would have never found my passion in makeup and beauty if I didn't have the opportunity to move to Canada and have all those doors open. So I think one thing I would want to tell the world is to pay attention, because a lot of the times we don't really notice something when we're not personally going through it. We don't really notice how bad it could be for others when we don't see ourselves. But I think especially now with social media, we can educate ourselves. We can really put ourselves in other people's shoes and their experiences. So I think we just need to be able to pay more attention and to be able to give them the resources that they need to fully reach their potential.
Now, many young people are listening to us now and they're thinking, wow, she can do it. But people see the end product. They don't think about what goes into it. What words of advice would you have for people listening to us talk?
Just because you see the end of this journey where I'm at Miss Universe, it was not easy. It took a lot of hard work. Miss Universe Somalia is not even a big organization. I have been my own director, my own manager. I'm running around, staying up at night, doing work. I'm really putting in that work. So there are times where it feels like it's impossible. There are times where you feel like you cannot do this because it's just you. But the biggest lesson that I've learned in this journey coming to Miss Universe, especially with that much resources, is I've learned to believe in God. And when I really believe in God, even the most impossible things really become possible. And this year I told myself I really want to go to Miss Universe. And I didn't know how that was going to be possible because there was no Miss Universe Somalia license. And I competed in Miss Universe Canada and I told myself I'm going to put everything I've got. I was working two different part-time jobs just to be able to get the money to compete in a pageant because it is expensive. And when I did Miss Universe Canada, I got third runner-up and that it was heartbreaking. But something told me that this is not over yet. And this was in August that this happened. And I still continued training. I kept putting in work. And then 2 months later, I got appointed as the first ever Miss Universe Somalia. And I think the biggest lesson anyone can learn from this story is that sometimes when an opportunity closes for you, there's always another bigger one that is coming your way. You just have to continue working hard, continue putting in the work, because sometimes when you don't see results right away, we tend to give up. And that's when you just need to push a little bit more because you never know what can happen. And this has been my journey. But to me, it's more than just about winning. It's about being really able to share my story because there's so many others who are listening right now. And I don't know how many people's life, I could change. I don't know, maybe the next Miss Universe for a different country happens because she was listening to my story and she also believed in herself. And that is my goal from this, to be able to really inspire people just by telling my story.
Well, listening to you, I'm thinking, why wouldn't she win? Good luck and thank you so much for talking to
us. Thank you so much. Thank you.
All right then, bye-bye.
Bye, have a great night.
And you too. Miss Universe Somalia, Khadija Omar. Focus on Africa was pulled together by Nyasha Michelle here in London. Susan Gachui was in Nairobi. Blessing Aderogba brought her side from Lagos. Patricia Whitehorn was the senior journalist in charge. Nick Randell, the technical producer. Andre Lombard and Alice Mithengi are our editors. We are on air and online and also on YouTube. I'm Audrey Brown and we'll talk again next time.
When we left, there was this wonderful feeling, but it was only the beginning of a nightmare.
This is a story that started with a job advert. A yacht owner looking for a crew to sail his recently renovated boat from Brazil to Europe.
For me, it was going to be a great adventure and an opportunity to gain a lot of experience.
But when police raided the vessel and discovered drugs...
cocaine, hidden under one of the beds.
It can't be!
A key suspect was miles away.
Everything revolved around him.
Who's the boss? A British guy. Fox.
Fox.
This is World of Secrets from the BBC World Service. Season 5, Finding Mr. Fox. Search for World of Secrets wherever you get your BBC podcasts.